Welcome to the Listics AFL podcast, where we analyse AFL list building, free agency, trade and the draft. We're also working to help everyone achieve their best possible mental health, and we'd like to acknowledge our podcast partners, Beyond Blue.
If you're feeling low, anxious, or you need to talk to someone, please contact the team at Beyond Blue. You can call them anytime on 1300 22 46 36, or visit them at the website at www.beyondblue.org.au.
Now, without further ado, I'm John Van Norden.
And I'm Sean Lewis, and it's Listics podcast time.
And we're back, Sean Doggy Dog. Hey, Trevor.
What's happening,
John Van? Yeah, not a lot, mate. Good to be back in the podcasting studios, the respective studios. We're still struggling to get some FaceTime with one another. There's plenty of going on in life at the moment, but it's always great to be able to jump on with Zencaster and be able to see your beautiful face and record on a Monday night.
It is. I wouldn't call my face a beautiful face, but it's a face for radio nonetheless, or a podcast.
Radio, podcast, the similar formats. I think that's the important thing.
That's it. What's been happening? What's mental health moment? What's the state of play? How are you feeling? How's your world?
Yeah, feeling good. It was a pretty stressful week, just work-wise last week, mainly for my wife. And those weeks are always typically nice little challenges for my mental health, mainly because it's sort of a constant stream of this is hard. And then also, am I struggling, or am I, like, is my wife struggling, and am I just feeling bad because not everything's good? And if that's the case, should I just do my best to support her, which is what I should be doing? So they're always really interesting weeks because I feel stronger probably after them, and I always feel more like myself when I'm going through them, because I can sort of fight to stay mentally present during the whole time. So probably just a week of focusing on my mental presence. How about you, mate?
Yeah, it's been a good week. Work's busy, which is always nice. I like being busy. I guess we had a bit of sickness run through the house last week with our bub from childcare, as I'm sure most parents will be able to tell you. Childcare is a wonderful place where they learn social skills and pick up every disease known to mankind. That was a little bit tough. Like, my wife being knocked out. She was basically down for the count on Wednesday. Was really struggling. She was all good Thursday and gradually came back to life. And then, we had a good weekend with family and still doing house renos. So it's all go at my place. But doing good.
You're getting through the bulk of the... You've broken the back of the reno though, haven't you?
Yeah. So just the laundry to go. I've just been plastering, getting ready to tile in the laundry. So that's been fun. Everything's going well for us. It's just those things that they can kind of take it out of you. It's always hard when your partner's, is crook. Especially when they're feeling under the weather. So I just have to be their support. And that kind of meant we couldn't do last week. And with everything going on in your world as well. I think overall, we're in a really good space, where... getting on top of everything now, doing lots of painting. Painting's boring for anyone who hasn't done it. Seems like a fun thing to do, but it's not really after.
Yeah, fun choosing the paint, fun getting all of the stuff for the paint. Fun even the first time you set up. But almost as soon as the brush hits the wall or the roller hits the wall, you're like, ah, oh, this sucks.
I'm over this already.
It's going to take forever. No, I feel that. But I mean, mate, it's... Not only, as you said, partners have had like a hard week, which makes things a bit harder, but AFL in general is having a bit of a hard time with injury. And I guess
it's
going to be a little bit of a flavor of the episode. It's just, I mean, everyone's sort of talking about it. Like, it's maybe it's a bit flavor of the month in terms of what we're all talking about, but it does feel like there are probably more injuries this year than there would be in previous years. I don't know if that's just because of the names. I mean, Dangerfield, Neil, Dunkley, Buddy's always on the injury list. Heaney's been on the injury list for a couple of years now as well.
Rory Sloane.
Yeah, he's been on and off the injury list. But I mean, they're all like captains. Yeah, so they're like captains and Brownlow medalists that are missing these games. So not no names, not to say that there's any AFL players that are no names, but
yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, it's a funny one. So I guess we were talking about this before the episode, and for listeners, it's kind of that thing. I think we kind of hinted at it in the New Rules podcast, in that, you know, like, I feel that the AFL overall, they've obviously gone for how they want the game to look, and they've done this standing on the mark and everything, but in their effort to reduce congestion even further, they've fatigued the players further. So the natural kind of thought process is, well, if you cut down to 70 interchanges, you're naturally going to have, you know, kind of more soft tissue injuries. But I did hear an interesting kind of theory. I can't remember which. It might have even been from a coach. It might have been David Noble. Not David Noble. Chris Fagan, actually, I think, said it. And he was talking about how, you know, potentially with the extra fatigue, players are just like, they're not as like their reactions and stuff towards the end of quarters are really fatigued as well. So like when they roll an ankle, their bodies are slower to react. And I'm not sure if there's any kind of science behind that. I'd be interested to look into it a bit more, but you know, just kind of hearing a bit of a theory, it kind of, yeah, maybe potential, like your body being fatigued should naturally be a bit slower.
Oh yeah, I've heard like all flavors for why things are happening. I don't know if it was McRae. It was definitely a big name player said the other day that what reduced rotations does is it allows you to recover and then get cold because you rotate less. So when you come off, you get stuck on the bench. You do most of your recovery in 3 minutes. And when you've got lots of rotations, you just go straight back on. And you rotate more frequently to get your energy back. But in these new rotations, you rotate less. So you get more tired when you're on the ground, and when you come off, you could be stuck off for 7 minutes. And there's times where you're completely ready to go back on the ground, but you can't just due to this artificial cap. So people go on cold.
Yeah. And out of the game. Yeah. And I guess looking through, like I've got the round 7 injury list up here. And I mean, there's a lot of like, not impact injuries, but like ankles and, you know, what's this, foot, ankle, shoulder, knee. These are all typically like more kind of change in direction impact, like not, impact's not the right word. They're kind of change in direction injuries rather than like hamstrings going and that sort of thing. So they kind of don't like, I guess it's that structural injury, I think is what I'm getting at. So like, you know, a shoulder can be an impact injury or it can be just a hyperextension the same as a knee or a knee. They can all have impact as well. You know, there was the ruck crisis where everyone was doing a PCL or clashing knees, which is why they brought in the center circle rather than having, you know, the Jeff White style run up and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, it's the unintended consequence of COVID as well. Like we went back to 16-minute quarters last year and then now you go on to 20 minutes. And not only that, last year was 16-minute quarters with a 90 rotation cap. Yep. Now you've gone to 20 minutes. So you've extended the game 20%. Well, it's gone back to its original, which is 20% longer. And potentially then you've pulled down the cap. And so now players are fatigued. They haven't played a longer game for a couple of years. So now they're naturally, you know, in this space where more injuries are occurring. And to be honest, like, I mean, on the weekend we saw some pretty good scoring, but generally speaking, the scoring for the last few weeks has been pretty sluggish. And so the whole idea of this stay in the mark, creating this fast game, and the fatigue meaning the game's more open, I don't actually think it, like, I don't think the fatigue is really helping. I think that's a bit of a miss. So yeah. I reckon I'd like to see them go back to 90.
Or yeah,
I think, that cap.
Yeah. Or like, so you pretty much covered off exactly the notes that I had, which were shorter games and a shorter season, followed by shortest preseason in recent memory because the season finished late, longer games this year with less rotations, and the introduction of a mandatory concussion period. It's a story. Like, that's like saying it like that in that order is definitely a story, but you can see that the effect of going less required long game fitness, a shorter preseason, and then an injection of longer games with less rotations and mandatory time off. If you get hit in the head, then it's gonna increase the injury list. It just feels like it's going to.
I just kind of think with it all, like, it's, I heard one of the coaches come out and say, oh, we should do 18 minute quarters. It's yeah. like, well, no, like, just increase the rotations, reduce yeah. the fatigue level. Maybe 70 is too far. Maybe we should be at 80 or maybe 90 where we were. Or maybe we just go stuff it and it's a free for all and we let the yeah. game be fast and yeah, open I know. And have a shootout.
Yeah, I totally like, and I think maybe it was Bevo that was saying that. He's like, why cap it at all? Like, just yeah. let clubs do whatever they want. Clubs can decide how many rotations they make or not. You can decide to rotate heavily or you can decide to leave people on for longer. Like, just choose. You can do whatever you want because you're the coach. Which I'm a fan of, because it's not as if we all hated watching the game in even 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012. Like, it didn't look bad. It was, there was definitely, you disagree?
I mean, indeed. No, I agree.
Yeah,
I
sorry, think... you shake your head.
This is the problem with video. Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. I mean, like, even if you go back to the early 2000s, like, there's nothing wrong. Like, that game was fun to watch back yeah. then. I mean, we had the 05, 06 defensive years, and then we had that kind of rollout from there of, you know, Geelong and Hawthorne and St Kilda and stuff with a bit more free-flowing games, but still built off the back of defense, Collingwood as well there. And it's just, I feel that the AFL has brought these rules in to try and get a certain type of game, but then unintended consequences are that certain type of game they're looking for was probably best served leaving the interchange cap at 90. And potentially some of these injuries don't happen. I still yep. think a lot of them, I still think quite a few of them do happen.
Yep.
Because as you said,
it's just random. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Dunkley, like, how can, you know, it's a dislocated shoulder. It can happen any week. Like, you know, Matt Rowell, the same thing. Like, how unlucky is that PCL? Like, that's got nothing to do with fatigue and,
yep.
and everything like yeah, exactly. that. You know, so it's kind of that, you know, there's a degree of this that's kind of natural, it's going to happen every season, and then there's also the artificial, which is probably more those, like, you know, you're probably seeing a few more high grade hamstrings and stuff. The one that I'm interested in is, like, there's not as many groins as you would think, like, for the heavy loading that people are having. Like, I think we had that spate, you know, kind of in the noughties of,
yeah.
of osteitis pubis kind of been the hot topic, and it seems like there's not as many, and I would have thought with an overloading type scenario that would be common, but maybe different training these days has helped that.
It's been replaced with a foot, is it navicular?
What's the
foot that everyone's getting at the moment?
Was navicular or Liz Frank are kind of the two bad ones.
I can't remember. There's the type of injury. It must be a navicular that I'm thinking of. That everyone's getting at the moment.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, like, and then the other thing is with these injury lists, and we spoke about this just before. So looking at the round seven injury list and knocking out guys who have kind of ongoing concussion symptoms, and like Daniel Venables, there are 10 people listed on here as concussions. Yeah. So, you know, last year, I would say that instead of 10, it would probably be like 2 or 3. So this mandatory 12-day concussion rule means that naturally all, you know, guys cop a head knock, naturally they're going to have more people on the injury list, because, you know, head knocks in some cases are avoidable, but in a lot of cases aren't. And now we're making people sit out longer. You know, we're just going to see that injury list build up.
Yep.
So, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting one. The injuries, it'd be good to monitor. But like, I think I said to you before, like, there are some clubs where you're just looking and you're going, wow, like, these injury lists are insane. You know, coming into round seven, North Melbourne, you know, Jed Anderson, Charlie Combin, Aiden Corr, Kyron Hayden, Luke McDonald, Flynn Perez, Polek, Phoenix Spicer, Robbie Tarrant. Like, that's a fair injury list to have at round seven.
Yeah.
You know, even a team like, say, St Kilda, which has recently got back a whole heap of guys, you know, we've still got Frawley, Geary, Gresham, Hanbury, Ben Patton, and I'm not sure if Webster got cleared or not, but he was listed as a test. You know, that and St Kilda's just recently got back like 4 players.
Yeah.
So, you know, like the injury lists are naturally longer at the moment, I feel. So, definitely something there, but whether it's a direct correlation to all the new rules or just a simple fact of fatigue, and we can correct it with an increase in the rotation cap.
Yeah, or if it's just chance, like as in if we wait until the end of the season and see whether there's been more weeks missed through injury than through other years, or if more of a certain type of injury, it'd be interesting to see that play out.
And I think it'd be naive to think that the teams that make finals often are the best injury management teams. Like, I think when we've done previous work, looking at injury history and the amount of players used per season, often inside of the top eight, there is the top, you know, say the top 10 teams at managing injuries in terms of players used over the season. So,
yeah,
you know, you only use 36 out of your list of 45 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Often those teams will do better than the team that's used 39, as a real high level sweep, because that's just how deep you're cutting in. And I think, you know, going back to like 2018, was that Port's, the year Port kind of shot up the ladder. No, it was Adelaide's year. So it's 2017. In 2017, Adelaide, I think, used the least amount of players. It was like 31 players over the season.
Yeah.
Port
and Brisbane had great runs with injury over the last 2 years now.
Yeah, and now you're starting to see like Brisbane's had a bit of an injury issue, and now it's testing their depth where they haven't had that before. So, you know, it would be more injuries in the game is not good, but in terms of the natural order, generally speaking, it's the teams that manage injuries the best or keep most players fit on the park, whether that by pure luck or good management, either way. They're the teams that often have an inside run into finals. And then you kind of, you know, obviously your age experience and all that stuff feeds into it. But, you know,
yeah, it definitely helps.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
and one of the other things that we've been touching on pre-episode was some of the other things that keep people off the park in suspensions. And there was a couple of suspensions. I mean, Sean always gets touchy when any Melbourne player gets suspended, feels that it's very unjust.
But I don't believe that any of that is what I said. I think I said Bailey Fritsch should be suspended for a week. I'm just a little confused at how they got there.
Yeah, I think that so when we initially started the discussion, it was around medium impact and what is medium impact, and is medium impact how impacted the player is, or is it something else? And you read the you've gone ahead and we read through all the rules before we jumped on. What did it end up being?
Yeah, so medium impact. So we'll get the guidelines open here. And so when you read through all the guff of the guidelines, it obviously is very loose and it makes itself wide and enabled to be manipulated however they choose to see fit. But what was interesting when it talks about impact, it said consideration will be given as to whether the impact is low, medium, high or severe, and determining level impact regard will be had for several factors. They pretty much summarizing extent of force and any injury sustained to the player is the first one, but that then says the absence of injury does not preclude the classification of impact as severe. So basically saying just because someone wasn't injured severely doesn't mean you can't be graded as severe.
Yeah.
And then the strong consideration will be given to the potential cause of injury, particularly in the following cases. And the first one you read, intentional strikes such as those swinging with a clenched fist, raised forearm or elbow. So it talks about intentional strikes from an elbow. Now, I think reading that, you kind of sit there and go, oh, well, Fritsch is pretty lucky to escape with 1 week.
Yeah.
Because if we roll back and we say, because it's an elbow, and usually elbows, I think, are regarded as intentional, I think, is what the history was. Although I believe there's a Buddy Franklin example where it wasn't.
Yep.
And if that's the case, intentional, even at medium impact with high, is a two-match suspension.
Yeah.
But the interesting part is it talks about like the potential to cause injury. So how do you grade potential to cause injury and call it impact?
Yeah.
Because, and this is the part where you and I are really struggling, is that we're not arguing Fritsch didn't deserve a week.
We're saying he did deserve a week.
We're
of the completely of the camp that he deserved a week, and it's you're sort of pointing out. Go.
Yeah, I mean that's the problem. Like I just don't like I kind of read it and I go, well, you're basically saying that well he didn't cause an injury, and you know by all accounts is fine. Didn't do a concussion test surprisingly, despite being hit in the head. I'm sure North can explain that one away.
Well, this is how this conversation started. You said to me, how did it get medium impact if there was no concussion test and the impact was negligible? Like, as in, it's been proven that there was no injury. And I said that they use medium impact as a way of grading a player to get a suspension when contact is high. They always, if it's high contact, they give you medium impact because it'll draw a week's suspension. And the other examples that I sort of gave to sort of back this up was Ben Long on McRae in, I think it was just before finals last year or maybe in the first final. McRae got straight up, played immediately, medium impact, and he gets a week. Zach Williams in the preseason comes off the line, hits Hunter Clark in the head. Hunter Clark gets up, plays out the game, no concussion, medium impact, gets a week. Now, in all of those cases, we are 100% saying that player should be suspended. But under the current structure of the rules, the AFL have two levers to pull in order to draw that higher suspension, that higher grade, which draws a suspension. One is medium impact. The other is intentional. Now, in those cases, I think what they actually think is that it's pretty close to intentional. Zach Williams coming off the line and jumping straight through. He might not be intending to hurt someone, but he is coming off the line of the ball. Same with Ben Long incident. I don't think it was the same with Bailey Fritsch. If anything, I think Bailey Fritsch has been slightly hardly done by here. But based on all of those, they would be very hard-pressed to defend an intentional call. So this is why they grade things as medium, because if they said it is intentional, they'd be like, that wasn't my intent. My intent was to hit him in the body. I just accidentally got him a little bit high.
Well, that's why they grade it careless.
Yeah, that's so. why they're great at careless. So they need to get that medium impact really to drive the suspension.
Yeah, because if they graded it as low impact and intentional, they get the one match. But then they've got to prove the intent, as you're saying. So, but the interesting thing is they put the caveat in there that they can talk about potential for injury.
Yeah, which is now, which is why they do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, like, let's really, if we want to talk about honestly about what happened with Fridge, the if Tom Powell, and thankfully he got away with nothing, but if Tom Powell had a fractured jaw and a concussion, Bailey Fritch is serving 3 weeks.
Yeah, no doubt.
That's the potential to cause injury. The potential is severe. Like the injury could have been a very severe injury, and he's had negligible injury. And so they've just basically, you know, gone and, oh, well, it's medium impact because you could have hurt him, which you could probably do for just about every incident in the AFL game, if we're honest. But because they don't actually explain that they're talking about potential in the impact when they issue it, it's just ridiculous. Like there's no explanation here, and they've tried to lump everything into this contact or into the impact, saying, well, the impact is medium impact. Well, you know, if I'm Melbourne, I'm going to roll the dice at the tribunal.
Yeah.
I would love to see the medical report. I'd love to just put it all on the table and go, well, okay, how have you deemed this a reportable offence if the player has gotten up and there's no injury and your whole entire system is based off people being injured? Which
well, this is what we, I guess, don't like about it, is that the impact would suggest impact, but the way that impact is judged is impact plus potential for impact or potential for injury. So that argument will fall on deaf ears because it says in the rules that a judgment will be given based upon potential as well. That'll be graded. Why then would you not just pull out potential and have that as a fourth element of the grading? So at the moment, there are three elements to the grading, which is whether the action was intentional, careless, reckless. I can't remember what those ones are.
Intentional, careless. There's four impact levels, severe, high, medium, and low. And then the contact's either high or to the groin.
Yeah.
Or body.
Yeah.
The two.
So those are the things you've got to move at the moment. I don't think that anyone would disagree that potential for injury is a really important measurement. Why not just pull it out and make an additional factor? So that one. Low impact, a high potential, 1 week. Any high potential draws a week.
Yeah.
There's your suspension.
Yeah, and the thing is, and this is what I think Melbourne should be. I'm standing here putting a Melbourne hat on. I actually think he deserves a week for it because we want to get it out of the game. I think fending with an elbow is a dangerous move. However, if I'm Melbourne, I'm going in and saying, does this actually constitute a reportable force level? The player has suffered no injury, and that's the thing. Like reportable offences, it has to be a classifiable offence. So, this is the thing. So they've classified it as striking. So is that a strike? I would have thought you'd go with rough conduct personally.
I mean,
but there's. You know,
I think that as I said, from the Ben Long and the Zach Williams incidents that we've sort of shown, and that's only in a few of the last rounds, we've been able to prove that there's other ones like that. The AFL won't bend on it. They'll just be like, yes. Yes, it was. It was reportable and you're suspended for a week.
But that's the point of an independent tribunal. So
yeah,
like that's not, it's not up for the AFL makes the argument in that scenario. They don't get to just decide. Good. So, and that's really where I come back to. Like, I keep thinking like there's so many holes in this and this why it's so confusing for everyone is there's so many holes and it's so convoluted. And it's like, you know, you read, this is the match review. Bailey Fritch has been charged with striking Tom Powell during the second quarter of the round 7 match. In summary, he can accept a one match with ban with an early plea. The early plea doesn't make any difference whether he gets one match or not. Based on the available evidence, the incident was assessed as careless, medium impact, high contact, and it's a one-match sanction as a first offence. The player can accept a one-match sanction with an early plea. And you sit there and you're like, well, there's no explanation.
Based on the current rules, they use impact as their explanation, but because they lump potential in there. And I think based on this whole discussion, if you pull out potential from impact and you rate it as a fourth category, think about some of the examples where this would play out. And you could actually get an even worse suspension than what we saw. Andrew Gaff would get severe impact, high contact, intentional. You should have a season, as in throw the book at the most guilty people in this circumstance. For the ones where it's Dangerfield earlier this year, high potential to cause injury, high impact, not intentional. So this is where you can drop your grading, because you can go, you didn't mean it. You may be careless, or I can't remember if it was rated careless, and high. So you should 4 to 5 weeks because of the potential to cause impact. And the one with all of these ones, 1 week, no impact. There was none. The person got up and played. There was no concussion, no injury, no nothing, but the potential was there, and you shouldn't be doing it. So rub it out. Go.
Sorry, the network's freezing a little bit between us. It really is we could so easily just do away with so much of this confusion with just a little bit more explanation. The player is this is what we've assessed. This is how we've determined. At the moment, they just give you the three lines. This is the incident. This is how we've graded it. This is the sanction, and move on. And the problem is now, that's an antiquated way of looking at it. We scrutinize these things now. People want to understand how you're applying the rules. And especially when you're one man. The MRO has been better since it's been one person. And I think Michael Christian has probably one of the most thankless jobs in football.
Yep.
And he does it well, I believe. But the problem is when you've only got one person, people need to understand what the thinking is. He's assessed it as medium impact. Is he saying because there was no injury, but there was a really severe potential, he's kind of balanced that out at medium?
Yeah.
And that's the way we've got to take it, because we have no other way of understanding it.
Yeah.
But
whereas is that the same as someone whacking someone punching someone in the stomach? Is it the same? As in probably medium to low potential to cause injury. It probably caused a medium to low injury and it would be intentional. So maybe you get one or two, without this whole thing, we could keep going on about it for days, because it's very simple. Tribunal, AFL, everything. Just break out potential and then you explain the potential in the ruling. So when we see Fritsch, it's easy to understand. High potential to cause injury, for high contact, there you go. And high and high instantly draws 1 week. If it was intentional, it goes up. Regardless of impact, if you intentionally strike someone in the head, instantly 3-4 weeks, even if you don't injure them. If it can be proven that you've intentionally struck someone in the head, you should be gone for weeks.
Yeah, and I think we've always said this, is the AFL has traditionally punished the result rather than the intent. And it's a bit like, you can take a wild swing at someone and get off with a fine. But if you, in Bailey Fritch's case, you get the ball, put up your arm for a fend off, and someone comes in and you make contact with the head, you've got a week.
Yep.
Well, the intent isn't there for him to nail Tom Powell in the head, but the bloke that's taken the wild swing, there's an intent there. And, we want to get the stuff that, we want to get Bailey Fritch's stuff out of the game, but that's a momentary reaction. Whereas, you know, the wild swing, that's a behavior and you need to stamp out.
Yep.
Like, you need to let people know you do it. You're going to spend a couple of weeks. It's not worth it. You know?
Yep.
And the same thing with jumper punches. Like, you know, surely now we're beyond the point where, you know, jumper punches are just kind of ignored. Finding people for them.
There's fines, but people still don't get suspended for rubbing someone else's head in the dirt.
Yeah.
I hate that. It was Cozzy Pickett this week, or the week before, but there has been heaps of that this year and at the end of last year, of an opponent being down, face down, and you sticking your knee in the back of their head, rubbing their head into the ground. Like, go on, get over it. Just like we're honestly trying to reduce injuries, and you think that kneeing someone deliberately in the back of the head to smush their face into the ground is a good idea.
Yeah.
Hate some of that stupidity.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not a good look. And I think that ultimately where kind of this all comes from is we're not arguing with the result here. I think the result is fine. Like a week suspension for that action is fine. We don't want people fending off with an elbow. And even to the extension, and I think I said it, is that if you fend off even with your hand and you make contact with someone's throat, like even that's got to start to be looked at because that has potential. But again, it's this loose wording. And like I said, every incident in an AFL game, you could probably somehow draw a potential from it.
Yeah.
And so then comes down to, you know, is it a reportable offence? Is the force level enough to be reportable? And like I'm saying with Melbourne, you look at the end of it, you'd say, well, is it a force level that's reportable? Because, you know, there's been no effect to Tom Power. Like he went off the ground and he was back on 5 minutes later.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even concussion tested somehow. I know.
You won't stop talking about that part.
I don't understand. For him, I don't understand it. Like,
yeah, fair. We're taking concussions more seriously this year. Yeah. Even Grimes. I think Grimes didn't get concussion tested during the game, but showed some symptoms afterwards, was concussion tested and has a concussion. He'll miss next week.
Yep. And that's fair enough.
That's good protecting the player. So we did want to talk about, I did a tweet on this week, but just some of the stuff to do with recruiting strategies. And we'll touch lightly on this because we're going to dive deep into it as we pick apart things throughout the year. But my point was mostly around Collingwood's trade last year, where they gave away their future first round pick for picks 24, 30 and a future fourth round pick. Now, the talk at the time was that they liked the players that were available and that they knew that they probably weren't going to be able to use that pick depending on where they would finish because it would most likely be eaten up in a bid. But it touches on too many of the things that we sort of talk about as being mistakes. One is present bias, which is overvaluing something that's right in front of you right now. That also ties in with discounting future value. So having a different valuation on the exact same asset just further in time, which they definitely do. And the other one was loss of bargaining, which loss of bargaining is something that we more talk about on the podcast, as in, we talked about it last year with Western Bulldogs not having any early selections. Not that they necessarily had to have pick two or anything like that, or that it would have changed things if they did. But in the case of maybe GWS with like your Tom Greens, I know that they traded up and above to get above the certain pick, but that's a strategy that they could play because they had picks. And they could go into a bit of a discussion with a club like Adelaide, where Adelaide says, you know, we're going to bid on your player. And you actually can play out that scenario where it's realistic that GWS could say, that's fine, we'll let you have him and we'll take somebody else. What typically happens is that you end up at a point where you make a trade so that both parties get a bit out of it. In that case, GWS got a selection before Green, so that they could take Ash, and Adelaide got a future pick as well. So there's things like that, but I guess the biggest thing with that whole loss of bargaining position is that it's just on top of the fact that they drastically overvalued where they would finish by trading out so many of the Pies' best team from last year. It's just bound them. It's bound them to way overpaying in this period. They're going to have to trade players out to get points to be able to afford a match or go into an even bigger deficit on their first round pick in the future, which they can't trade.
Yeah, exactly. They can't trade that one.
No.
I think it's just that fascinating. I mean, we talked about the first year with all this live trading. I think it was Sydney had Nick Blakey that year. And there was talk that the bid could land quite early. But Sydney held their first round pick until it got to the point where they could trade it. And then they did what we thought they would, which is trade back out and in after the bid came in, which was fine. But they didn't, they kind of, you know, they held that pick because it was more valuable in that year.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, the Pies' argument would be that, you know, Nick Dacos has a blinder this year, which he seems to be doing at the moment. And, you know, pick one and we're going to lose. It doesn't matter whether we've got pick four or pick 10, we're going to lose that pick. So, you know, it's not worth it. But if it impacts future years, it is worth it. Absolutely it is.
Yeah.
If you think this kid is really worth pick one, then you need to protect that future. And the Bulldogs did that with Jamara. Like, they came in with a first round pick. And then they somehow pulled a Swifty over Collingwood's eyes and managed to pull all the value for Jamara at pick one.
That's the big thing, is that once you have the assets to be able to trade back in that year's draft, you can get people overpaying for that first round pick with points that you need. Like, you can use that for more advantage, but Collingwood got less value because they traded out a future pick. Yeah. So, couple that with the fact that during the Dane Beams trade, they gave up two first round picks. And I know that they think they got a first round pick back in that as well, but it was a late one.
Yeah.
They've given up something like four or five first round picks in the last 3 years. And it makes me think that I don't reckon that they'll be able to do what I think it was. Maybe it was GWS trading out a future first round so that you take the deficit on your second round pick and then trade in above that. That's what GWS did this year. Because Freo took it on their... Yeah, that's right. Freo took the Liam Henry deficit before on their first round pick, whereas GWS didn't have one. They've just committed themselves to only one possible outcome. And it's really... really poor. I think that this all comes back to, I've done a couple of posts on this one issue this week. I think it all stems back to Collingwood's decision after 2018 to bring Dane Beams to the club. And this is nothing to do with Dane Beams, saying that like nothing to do with the issue of Dane Beams not playing right now. If Dane Beams was on the list playing right now, the club would be in the exact same or worse financial position. They would just have Dane Beams. They got into trouble by giving up first round picks, which meant that they were keeping more expensive players rather than draftees who were generally locked into lower contracts for a period of time, and bringing in a $500,000 a year at least contract into the club that now has to be paid out. And the gap between that, say it was $500,000 a year or $600,000 a year, I think that's probably what Beams was on for the last 3 or 4 years of his career, plus the $300,000 a year that the Pies are reportedly paying the Western Bulldogs for Treloar to play against us being the Pies.
You'll get there eventually.
We'll get there eventually. I mean, on the lifetime of saying it like that. That's Treloar's whole salary. That's 600 plus 300. That's Treloar still playing at Collingwood. Or Stevenson and Phillips still playing at Collingwood. Like, that's how bad the mismanagement of trading in a player at that period of time is for all of your first round picks, is it completely hamstrung their ability to do anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, like, it's worth also noting, like, when we talk about how bad last year's trade period was for the Pies. Like, at Jaden Stevenson and Artu Bozanavulagi, I can't pronounce it and apologize, and pick 39, and then they got 26, 33, and 70. So 26 and 33 for those, okay, fine, you can move on from that. But then you come back, and then they're trading out Adam Treloar, who, you know, they gave up two first-round picks for.
Yep.
They've traded him out to get pick 14 and this year's second-round pick. But then they've given them 26, 33, and 42 along with Treloar. Treloar on his own should have been worth 14 and the second-round pick. And regardless of them forcing him out the door and everything.
Yep.
You know, like, it just... like, there's no reason that pick 26 need to be there and all that. And then all of a sudden, your desire to trade for what they ended up, what was it? It was they traded their future first for 24 and 30. Well, they had 26 and 33.
I know.
Like, it's just baffling. And they would have, and they could have still held that first round pick. And
could have still held it. Yeah,
and then this year, where it's more, it will be slightly devalued if Dacos is going to go top three. No sweat. But the thing is, if you have a shit year and you finish third or fourth bottom, and you've got pick three or four, there's still a threat that you may not match that bid.
Still a threat. So there's both the threat that you may not match the bid, which is real, because there will be other players in that top three that you might value just as highly. And go, well, fine, you take him. We don't have to take him. We'll take this other guy who we actually want.
Yep.
And a top three pick is worth a shitload in the active trade market.
Correct.
So if you want additional value, you could get like late first round picks or heaps of points and future first round picks. You could get anything you wanted for that top three pick.
But you could trade it to next year.
You could do anything. Like, even if it was pick 18, even if you won the flag, pick 18 in a year where you need to match a bid for a top three pick player in someone like a Nick Dacos is worth more than 24 and 30 in a week draft.
Correct. Absolutely. It just baffles me that, you know, that whole thought process, oh, we're going to burn it anyway. Let's just get rid of it. It's clearly undervaluing the future, and it's really not, you know, you said it's unrealistic expectations, but like, even if they finished eighth and it's pick 11, like, the pick still holds value.
So much value. It's an early pick. And I mean, there's a couple of other clubs we've got here to talk about in regards to the recruiting strategies, but a few of them played this week in Essendon and the Blues, and really that whole Collingwood Essendon Carlton talking point from last week was annoying. So I don't really want to touch on it too much, but of course Essendon have some good young players this year, but in terms of a rebuild, they are further behind Carlton and ahead of Collingwood. That's like, it's really easy to rank them because the Essendon made some moves last year that were really positive towards reshaping the list. But for the 3 years before that, they'd done things that were negative towards reshaping the list. They brought in senior players. They overpaid with draft picks. Sorry. I mean, I hate to think, no, I would hate to be an Essendon supporter and think, what would the club be like right now if during the whole saga that went on, they committed to a rebuild at that time? They had assets that wanted to leave. They had to overpay to retain them. They could have traded them, got picks. They had a lot of good young players that were getting games into. That's where Zerit really stepped up and continued to.
Parrish was playing midfield and doing well.
Who, surprise, surprise, now he's a midfielder again. He's doing well.
Oh, but shock.
But they could have committed to that path and been multiple more early picks or young players along the way towards being a great young team. Now, the Blues are further ahead in that. They've made some serious blunders in terms of who they select, and that is mostly, in my opinion, due to selecting too many reject players from, not reject, too many recycled players from GWS and other clubs. They continually needed to look like they were moving forward. And in order to do that, they brought in players that had been in the system for two, three years. So they were more advanced than draft picks, and they just didn't expose themselves to positive luck. They've also had the bad luck slash bad recruiting of getting some guys that haven't come on in the way that they would have wanted them to.
Yeah, but have they not come on because they've had the rug pulled out from under them when Bolton...
Yeah, when Bolton left, exactly. Yeah.
And, and part of that is, and this is where, you know, your recruiting and your list team have to... Sorry, your recruiting list team and your coaching really have to be on the same panel, because effectively, you know, when Bolton left, you know, he was clearly rebuilding through youth. But, you know, they weren't seeing these huge strides of improvement. And so he was exited and Teague came in, and Teague put faith in the older guys. And that's fine when they're performing, and they performed admirably for a couple of years. But now those older guys are starting to struggle because they're 2 years older than they were when he took over. And
yeah.
All of a sudden, that's exposing the fact that now you, all these games that you had given in to guys like Paddy Dow and Petrovsky Seaton when he played a little bit in the middle, and, you know, these guys who've been playing, Fisher, you know, these guys who now have under Teague have either been on the fringe or playing in other positions, they're not coming through strongly because, you know, they've had the high, you know, it's a mental roller coaster that they've faced. And, and, you know, like, how hard is it for you know, Petrovsky Seaton, who's played, you know, off the halfback line for a lot, you know, when he was really drafted as a midfielder?
I mean, I totally agree. You know that it was probably 4 years ago when Bolton was coaching and Fisher was playing midfield, and I said, I think Fisher's going to win a Brownlow by the time he retires.
Yeah.
I was that confident on him because of the way that he moved in and around the stoppage, the fact that he could go to a wing. He was a reasonable kick and could get forward and kick a goal. He had all the elements, but was the first player shifted out of that midfield when they brought Gibbs, Murphy and Curnow back into the core. And look, I strongly believe that you should continue playing your leaders in positive roles for them, and that you should keep leadership in players probably that are above 25. I think Cripps maybe got the captaincy a little bit early. Curnow could be captain for a couple of years with Cade Simpson as vice captain, and support with guys that have really made it. But that whole shift has slowed them down a couple of years. I think that they've been unlucky with injury or poor at managing it. But they probably start to look a bit more exciting if Fisher is back and playing on the wing or closer to the ball.
Yeah.
And if Curnow is ahead of the ball, and if they can start to settle down some of these. Like, for anything for me, I would go really quickly. Zach Williams, we tried you in the midfield, didn't work. You move into the halfback flank. You're playing in a four-pronged attack with Saad, Doherty, Newman and Williams. That's all of your smalls and rebounding and intercepting players. And then you've got Waitering and probably Liam Jones. Now you've got a really, really good back six. That's an excellent back six structure. Then you put Zach Fisher back onto the wing where he belongs. And you probably, like, what, Cripps, Walsh in the middle, Pitney, fine. Like, I mean, you would probably want a better ruckman, but you're getting towards having the core of a team that is going to be really threatening for a few years if they can get back to where they were without this blip.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting, like, looking at, and I think we made the point last year in one of the podcasts, people kept saying Carlton was a young team, and I think it was a game against Melbourne where they took Melbourne to the wire and kept saying they're a young team. And that, like, the only reason they were older than Melbourne was because they had Simpson and Betts. But even when you took out Simpson and Betts as the two oldest players, and you took out two oldest players in Melbourne, they were still, you know, significantly older than Melbourne in that game. And I think we did a whole episode on it and saying that Carlton, whilst, you know, they give the appearance of a young team, in that they do have young players. They're not young week to week. Like on the weekend, if we have a look versus Essendon, you know, just talking on pure averages, you know, they're 25 years and 5 months. So yeah, 25.5 roughly, and 89 games of experience. So if we look at that and then we say jump, you know, what's an older team in your opinion? Just pick one.
Well, the oldest is Geelong, but that's probably not fair because they're old by too far.
Brisbane at Port Adelaide, that's probably a good one.
Yeah, Port Adelaide's a good one, yep.
Yeah, so Port Adelaide, 25 years and 6 months.
Yeah.
And five more average games.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've got the same, and again, we're talking averages, they've got the same averages as Port Adelaide, pretty much, very close. And they're excited about beating Essendon, who they're over a year older and 20 and 15 games more experience on average.
Yeah.
So like they're not that young a team. And like even, I don't know, like Richmond and the Dogs, you know, they're both over 26. So yeah, they're starting, they're the more experienced. So I think they kind of sit in that middle bracket. Like,
I think that some of the,
it's the same as Melbourne.
Yeah, I just think there was some stupid commentary around it saying that I think it was that Carlton had another high score against, rather than talking about the fact that it was a good win, which look it was. They were down and out after all of the commentary last week, and they came back. They fought really hard and they won. And there was a lot of talk about Essendon being exceptional, baby bombers, that type of stuff. After they had only won one game, then they beat the second bottom team on the ladder, and then they lost to Carlton. So they're still young, and that's fine. It's just, let's just set realistic expectations about all these teams. Blues are way further ahead in terms of age profile and readiness to move up the ladder. Whether that results in a premiership or not is completely, in my opinion, irrelevant. A lot of it's going to be due to luck and circumstances at the time, as in who else is competing. I don't know who is closer out of any of those clubs to a premiership because they're so elusive. In terms of competing, though, it's the Blues. They're the closest to competing.
Yeah, they are. But then Mark Murphy retires, Eddie Betts retires. Who else is there? Just off the top of my head, I'm trying to...
Liam Jones is getting older.
Hang on, here we go.
Kaz Bolt is over 30.
Yeah, Kaz Bolt's 30, yeah. Hang on. Eddie Betts, Mark, and Ed Curnow's 32.
Yep.
You lose those guys and all of a sudden they're facing a shortage. So, you know, 19-year-old Corey Durden, you know, gets a look in for Eddie Betts maybe. Sam Philp, Liam Stocker, these sorts of guys start to come in, Paddy Dow.
Which they need.
But they need to do it now.
They need to do it now.
That's my problem. Like, I think even though, yes, they are closer because they've got a bit more experience, the problem is they're not going to get there because that experience will be gone by the time they get there. And then they haven't put enough. They're not getting repetitive games into these guys at 23. You know, the guys who are 23 on your list, which they have a fair few of, you know, they need to be getting lots of games in. And so Wiedering, McKay, Setterfield when he's fit, Petrovsky, Seaton.
Setterfield's been playing in the twos and fit.
Oh, has he? Well, yeah. You know, well, there's another one.
Setterfield.
You know, like...
Yes.
These are the guys they need to be putting games into. And, you know...
I totally agree. And look, I don't think that the strategy is to do what Melbourne did with J-Mac back in the day and delist all of your leaders and your senior players. I don't think that's a strategy. I don't think the strategy is to keep playing them at a high volume on the ball. So it's good that they've moved Murphy off, but it's probably time to start seeing if maybe you can shift Curno out of the center bounce and play him like a defensive on baller, one like starts on a wing and transitions in, or starts in the half forward line and comes up and plays on the ball after that. But build your new on-ball team. Like, we should be starting to see Stocker, as much as apparently he's a defender, getting 20% CBAs. Like, these guys just need to start getting center bounce rotations. They need to start getting rotations into Durden in the forward line, even though he's a first-year player, because they're going to be called on pretty soon and they need to be ready to step up or step out.
And if you have a look at, you know, teams like Richmond, you know, like, they made Riley Collier-Dawkins wait till his third season to get his debut. And that's okay, because they've got a strong system and they can do that. But, you know, if he was at a lot of other clubs, he would have been playing sooner. And it's not because he lacked the skill. He's come in and made a really good impact in his first game because he's been made to wait for it. But at the same time, you know, you think of like 2 years of development into him at a different club, and, you know, he's potentially a very good AFL player at this stage. And, you know, we've seen obviously with GWS, like, you know, Tom Green's now come into their midfield and he's starting to, you know, in his second season, really starting to do some good things. You know, he's going to be up and down. That's just what young players are like. But you know what? GWS, they've kind of had this, you know, mini meltdown with players leaving and everything. And they've taken the chance, okay, well, maybe this year isn't the year where we're going to contest top four. We might make finals. We might not. So be it. But what we're going to do is we're going to get, you know, we're going to get Hogan up and firing and see if he can, you know, and he can lead our forward line. We're going to get, you know, Green in there. We're going to, you know, we're going to trial Connor Stone, give games to Xavier Halloran. Like, they're really starting to get some more games into that youth. And you know what? They've got such a nice list build that, you know, in, you know, they could easily be bouncing back to top four next year.
Yeah. And you know what youth doesn't do? Cost money. It doesn't. It doesn't. Youth is the most affordable way to be able to build a premiership side. And do you know what the reason why Richmond are more than happy to bring in a rookie listed player, turn them into a Dan Butler, and then let them go? Is because as soon as they get more expensive, you don't need to keep them anymore. We just go back to the drawing board and find another player of about that same standard. They've done that with Jake Arts. Jake Arts is worse than most of those small forwards they've brought through. Mm-hmm. You know what? Not that much worse. He's playing a role. He plays the same role, and the role is low cost, high pressure, small forward.
Yeah, but it's Castagna. It's, you know, that's the same thing, you know.
Low cost, high pressure. And, like, they have roles like that they can roll out all across the field. Nathan Broad. If Nathan Broad wanted to leave, it would suck. They'd probably get a reasonable pick for it, and they'd probably go get Highmore, a player like Highmore, and they'd play him. Yeah. But you know what? They'd play him. They'd just be like, all right, this is your role. Play your role and you get a spot in the team. We'll back you and you'll develop. There are massive differences across the competition in terms of how successful people are at growing talent. And it's not fair to compare all, because I think that the players that were at Melbourne during those dark years, copped it. They lost the potential to be great players.
Yeah,
as did a lot of the players during the Blues rebuild eras. During the Essendon supplement saga, there have been players that have lost parts of their future because they have not been exposed to the right type of environment. So, look, I blame the clubs for that way more than I do the players. But there comes a time where I guess the clubs need to own up to it. The biggest one for me is, as I said, I'll be sour on this one forever if he never ends up being a star, is Zach Fisher. As a 19 or 20-year-old kid, was averaging about 20 disposals a game, more uncontested, but a mixture of contested, uncontested. It would be so great for them right now to have a Zach Fisher-type midfielder next to Walsh, who is a balanced midfielder, and Cripps, who is a contested midfielder. That is a three is your midfield. That's it. Instead, they've lost 2 years of development and a whole lot of confidence in him to try to appease maybe members, but not even. And this is the thing I hate the most about all of that. if the club said, we back the coach, and here's why. We're still trying to win, but we want to develop these players. That's not tanking. We want to win, but we need to develop these high pick players that we're putting forward because these guys are the future of our club. Stick with us. And you stick to that strategy, and you can increase the senior player time in the midfield from 20 to 30 or 40%. Don't just switch it all on to, and make it 70 or 80% to try to win games. Like, give the guys time to develop. The supporters will stay with you. What the supporters hate is this short-term flip-flopping around strategy changes with the whims in order to someone to keep their job or someone to justify that they're making the right type of moves. That's like Collingwood in the off-season, trading in all of those draft picks to try to say, here's why we did it. Look how fantastic this trade period was. It was rubbish. They're just trying to hide their mistakes.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting, like the other side of it is, to me, is this whole, the whole list management, like payment side of things. So Carlton's gone and eked itself some space, and they've gone out, they've got Adam Sard, they've got Williams, you know, they've gone out and got all these players. But the kind of thing I sit back and look like, is it worth paying? But just because you got the money there, is it worth paying the wrong type of player that money? So would Carlton have been better off being in the Brad Crouch race, for example? Because St Kilda has all the same types of midfielders, and probably getting Brad Crouch hasn't complemented it as much as they probably wanted. Brad Crouch would actually be a reasonably good fit. Like, he'd be a reasonably good replacement for Ed Curno.
Yeah, exactly. A 26-year-old version. And Zach Williams would be pretty good at St Kilda.
Yeah, exactly. Because it gives that bit of a different mix. And it's that, it's, yeah. And I guess, like, when you're going to throw big coin at players, you've got to be certain it's the right type of player. Like, Williams and Sard, both great players. But I'm probably only taking one of them. I don't need them both. It's just that inability to kind of and North Melbourne was guilty of it a few years ago, where they exited a whole heap of their stars, but then they were still competitive. And then they did the Pollock trade, and they did a few other things, and you're just kind of like, okay, where are you actually going with this? Like,
yeah,
if your target is, as every team's is winning a premiership, all you're doing is building a ladder to the middle. Like, you're not building a ladder to the top four and putting yourself in the hunt for a flag. And Melbourne's been guilty of it before. But again, it only takes one good season for strategy to be proven right, which is what happened with St Kilda last year. But even then, this year with the injuries, like, it's, well, was it right? You know, St Kilda's, you know, we're seeing the same developmental stall in some St Kilda players. Guys like Hunter Clark and Nick Caulfield and that sort of thing, they seem to be stalling a bit. And part of that is, for Hunter Clark, it's, you know, he's a midfielder. He was always a midfielder. I've had countless arguments and killed people telling me he's a halfback flanker. I'm sorry. He's a midfielder to me. He'll always be a midfielder.
Yeah, he's a midfielder with three older guys playing his spot.
Exactly. And it's like, so what's the cost? Like, they need him. He's how they get further up the ladder. He takes that next step. He can be a really elite player. But
I mean, I totally agree. And what you're sort of talking about there with, you probably just need one of Sard or Williams. You know what? Sard's probably on 500,000-600,000 plus. You had to trade out pick 8 to get him. I would have gone, I'd rather overpay on Williams, who's younger, and I'll keep pick 8 and I'll take that to the draft, and I'll have another, like, that's another top 10 pick building into the pipeline of players. But I'm gonna have to finish up in a second anyway. We're past the 10:30 mark just now. And I could rant about this all night.
I know you could.
Do you have anything just before we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, just to talk about pick 8, because I think it's a good one. Pick 8 was Nick Cox. And pick 9 was Archie Perkins.
Yeah.
Two players who would fit Carlton very nicely. Like, as you said, Liam Jones is getting towards the back end of his career. Nick Cox could play a couple of years and slot in there. Or you're looking for a difference maker, you know, without having Charlie Curnow. Archie Perkins can be that, and then potentially develop into a different midfielder for you over time. That's the impact. You've traded Saad maybe on a cheaper contract, but obviously, as you said, the pick eight and
Tanner Brun could have been available. Like, balanced midfielder with skills, can play forward early, can free up Zach Fisher to move back into the midfield. Like, there's so many options at that pick.
Well, like, they could go get a Luke Pedler or a Tom Powell, who are just an out and out midfielders.
Yeah.
And, you know, allow Cripps to have a bit more internal support. And because what we spoke about at the start of the season, where I was worried in the Supercoach episode, I was worried about what Cripps had to do for Carlton to get better. And it's kind of played out for us. Yeah. And, you know, I would like to see Carlton go get an inside midfielder to support Cripps and allow him to play that one out position where he can be so impactful, where he can win the ball and then step out into the out of the contest and use that big body to break it rather than just being the feed that he is at the moment. And he has to play that role because they've got no one else. So, and it's allowing Walsh to star, and we're seeing, you know, all this great work from Sam Walsh. But Patrick Cripps is proving why he is the captain, because he's actually sacrificing his game for that, for the betterment of the club, which I think is very admirable.
And Tom Powell, who's playing some really good footy, just to go full circle, being one of the guys that was hit in the head at the start of the episode, is a great example of why when you draft a midfielder, you play them in the midfield.
Yeah, absolutely is. So, final words. All right. It's been a good episode, actually.
I've liked it. I'll be interested. I think
we're a little flat at the start, so apologies for that. But I think we built into it. I think
you were flat. I shined from moment one.
I doubt that.
But I always love jumping on here with you. Always love chatting to everyone that listens to the podcast. And thank you again. If you are a listener and you're a regular and you love the podcast, and there's a friend or family member that loves footy as well and haven't listened to the podcast before, do share, do follow the podcast, do give us a recommendation, do jump online and give us a review. It all helps. And we continue to build up. I mean, I still picture that one day in the future, I don't know how far this is into the future, we could be doing this as a living, and we're not trying to make money out of it at the moment. We don't have a Patreon page or anything like that, but if you can support us in any way with a quick review or something like that, it'd mean a lot to us.
Absolutely. Appreciate everyone for listening, and I think probably starting in 2 weeks' time, we're going to probably jump into our list reviews.
We will.
I think we'll probably wait until I finish painting my house and then we can do it, because I have a bit more time.
The paint review and then the list reviews.
Yeah. You can come and inspect it, John.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Yeah.
All right. No. Love you. I'll chat to you
soon. See you guys. Bye.
If you constantly worry that the worst is going to happen, you're not alone. 1 in 4 Australians will experience anxiety. Know when anxiety is talking. Visit Beyond Blue to start a life beyond anxiety.